Hello and welcome to the Lean on Agile show. I'm your host, Shaheen, and I have a very good friend of mine, Jamie Good. Jamie, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, no problem. I'm so happy to be on this with you.
I know Jamie from a while back when I was listening to him and speaking about disruption at Spark and the Change conference. And I thought that this is a very good time to talk about disruption in this timing that we are in. I wouldn't do the justice to introduce Jamie for you guys, so I ask him to introduce himself. So Jamie, tell our audience who Jamie is.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much. So I call myself a senior learning experience designer right now, but that's just a big word to describe somebody who designs learning for people and organizations to be able to solve some challenges and help people get the skills and knowledge they need to just do their work, basically. And that encompasses for me quite a few things like cognitive science, experience design, and best practices around learning. But I find it really fun because there's always something different to dig into. So that's what I'm kind of focusing on right now, is designing learning for people and organizations.
Nice. And I guess these days, all of this learning that are designed are going to be online.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah. It's funny how I find with this current pandemic that the online sort of learning scenario was, for some people, something they didn't want to touch, but now a lot of people don't have a choice. So I see a lot of people scrambling to try to figure it out.
Right. And there are lots of disruptions that is happening in our lives, in our professional lives. Mm-hmm. You are the expert on that. Tell us more about the disruption. How shall we deal with that?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I always have that, I believe it's Periclides, that quote where the only constant is change. And it's funny, this is a very big global change that, like, I think it's affecting everybody. I don't think any country is really immune to this change right now. And I think they've said, what, 2/3 of the world are in lockdown or something crazy like that. It's something that is always constant in our lives, though, change. And sometimes it has a bigger impact than other times. But I think if you're settled to be accepting of that reality, then when something like this hits you, it's not as disruptive as it could be maybe for someone else. But again, everybody has their own unique circumstances, so that's different. And some companies, similar situations, some companies have been through tons of change. They've been through kind of a roller coaster of ups and downs. And so they've had maybe systems in place, or they've hired the right people to be able to handle the change. But I can see that there's a lot of people who weren't really ready for this. So one of the things I think is super curious about disruption is it really shows you whether your niche was a good choice or not, if that makes sense.
Right.
There are some people, I think, for example, I've been super curious about looking at what's happening to quote unquote Instagram influencers right now, who make their money off of free travel and getting sponsored posts on Instagram, and they can't travel right now. So they're scrambling to find something else to do. And I've been looking at things like that and thinking, wow, did we get too niche over the last 10 years? Mm-hmm. And is that to our detriment right now?
Right. True. Yeah. You mentioned the Instagram travelers. There are lots of professions that has been opened up because of this technology, that it was disrupting the old way of living, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be a travel guidebook that you used to go and buy or get it from a library, read about some place that you want to go. And you could buy those at the airport when you're traveling, for example, to a city in Europe. Like, on your travel, you get to know that city, you plan it, right? But nowadays, everything changed. And again, it changed because of this pandemic as well, right? So as you said, change is the only constant. Yeah. When it comes to change, as you know, I'm from the Agile world. One of the things that I really enjoy about Agile Manifesto is the responding to change over following a plan. So in the disruption, it shows best. I want to hear your thoughts, right? So how much can we be prepared to respond to such change over following a plan?
Yeah, that's a good, I love that sentence, actually. It's very true, and it's very difficult for a lot of people. I mean, I've been thinking lately, just as kind of a, to make people smile a little bit, to put out some sort of phrase like, let's have a moment of silence for micromanagers right now, because they must be suffering a lot. And those people usually want to follow a very certain rigid plan, and you can't, especially in a time like we're in right now. I mean, there's a lot of people who make a lot of money from doing keynote speeches, for example, at conferences, and all of those conferences are canceled right now. So if that was your plan for revenue for 2020, you've got to be thinking of something else right now. So I like this idea that you're saying, you know, respond instead of follow a plan. And it, but it's difficult. There's a mindset that you're referring to here, I think, that a lot of people can't really, no pun intended, get their head wrapped around. Because sometimes when you have, for example, I had a client that has 5 kids. I can't even imagine dealing with this global pandemic with all your kids at home and not in school right now, and still being able to quote unquote follow a plan. But I would imagine that in a household like that, you probably have to have some sort of plan or routine in place to make things work and to not go crazy. So how do you balance that? How do you kind of consider, okay, like we need some sort of routine so that these 5 kids don't drive me crazy and I can still get my work done. But then like you're saying, how do I just respond in the moment and be okay with the fact that things don't go according to plan, don't go the way I want, and I can't do the things that I think might be the best for this situation? It's mindset. It's heart and mind, I think, connected to try to figure out, how do I sit with this reality of the fact that there's so many things beyond my control? And that's one of the main things that I've been reflecting on since all of this started, is there's so much outside of my control. When I'm inside my condo, there's most of the things going on here that I can control. But outside this door and outside my building, there's really nothing I can control. I can't control whether someone in the grocery store stands too close for me, for example. I can't control that hand sanitizer has run out, for example, or that I can't get a mask, or I don't know, a number of things like that, that the borders are closed or that someone loses their job. These things are things that we can't control. And I think it's quite a good idea and a good practice to kind of sit and reflect as often as you can on the fact that these are things out of your control, and therefore, how accepting are you of that reality?
And for accepting that and planning for that takes lots of courage and investment.
Yeah,
if I may say, right? Because it's easy for when you are in a normal situation, don't think about any alternative that's gonna happen and don't plan for it, because you're used to your routine and your family routine and the way that everything works.
Mm-hmm.
Going out of that comfort zone and thinking about, okay, so what's going to happen next? If something goes wrong, what can I do? What shall I do? It takes energy and time, energy, and even material for you to go over it. So not many people, or not most of the people that I know, would do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's fear, I think, too, right? When you have a plan, you kind of, one of the things you're doing, of course, is trying to reduce risk. And when things kind of go not according to plan and there are surprises, then there's fear. Like, what happens tomorrow? What happens when I go to the grocery store during a pandemic? What happens if, you know, I fall and I break my leg and I suddenly need to go to a hospital where there are, an overloaded emergency room because of people that have COVID, for example.
Right.
So I think it's natural for our brains to always be scanning for threat. And so therefore we're trying to mitigate risk as much as we can, because threat is real. And right now there's a ton of threat.
Right.
I mean, it feels weird just going for a walk right now, because you go down the sidewalk and you see someone coming towards you and you're like, they feel like a threat. Like, I need to distance myself like 2 meters from this person. And that's not the normal way that we operate. We usually are comfortable and safe in our tribes. And right now we don't have our tribes, really.
Yeah. We are social animals. That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Jamie, you mentioned that you're a learning designer expert. How would you help people learn about disruption if you have to design something very niche for them?
It's funny because when you saw me speak back at Spark the Change a few years back, I don't know if you remember, but the exercise I had everybody do at the end was figure out a way to basically bring down Tangerine, the banking company, the financial company. I was kind of being a little cheeky because following my talk was the CEO of Tangerine. So I wanted people to kind of think about this in terms of, like, let's say you are working for, let's say, Tangerine or RBC or Home Depot or whoever. I think it's a good exercise to sit in the boardroom and think about ways that you could bring the company down. What could you build? What could you design? What kind of customer service could you do that would put your, like, if it was another company, that would put your company in danger or in jeopardy of succeeding? And I think that is something that is an interesting, different way of thinking. I got this idea from Dave Gray, and I think it's very smart that we're typically planning for success and thinking about what are we doing second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter of the year? What are we doing next year? What's our long 5-year plan? And sometimes in the boardroom and in planning these things, it's kind of in a vacuum, so to speak. And if we were to kind of break out of that and pretend we're outsiders and we're the competition, and how would the competition be planning to bring us down? Mm. How would, for example, the Lonely Planet, that company like you were mentioning before, you get those travel books and you see how and where you're going to, you know, plan your travel. And then suddenly Instagram comes along. I mean, I use Instagram and I save photos for places I'm going to travel to so that I can then visit those places once I'm at my destination. And by the way, Lonely Planet just laid off a whole bunch of people this week. So, I mean, disruption is happening.
Right.
And so for Lonely Planet, for example, then how would they sit around and not just think about what kind of books they want to put out, what kind of content in those books they want to put out, but what is possibly coming that might disrupt their business? And think about what are the ways that someone would want to bring us down as a company. And maybe they would have thought about something like Instagram coming up, an image-based social media platform. Maybe they would have thought about the fact that people are going to just be their own travel agents, for example, right. Or that people are going to take their cell phones and while they're on a trip and their GoPro, they're going to make their own travel guides. Maybe if they had sat down and thought about how other people might disrupt them, they maybe would be in a better spot right now. So that's one of the things that I think is good in terms of learning, is helping people learn to think differently about what they're doing and not just about their own company, but how does the competition see them and how is the competition possibly building something or designing something that's going to put their success at risk.
Right. Yeah, it's a good exercise. Have you ever had experience doing that exercise on a personal level? Because I think at a personal level, look at yourself as someone that bringing value to other people's lives. You can then think about what value can someone else bring value that is going to decrease my value.
Yeah, for my example of this for my own life, like I've been doing it since, but the kind of main example that first comes to mind was maybe, my God, it's probably 10 years ago already now, time goes so quickly. Yeah. Excuse me. I was digging into like learning and development, you know, designing workshops, the typical, you know, face-to-face thing with handouts, PowerPoint slides, all that stuff that everybody was doing and some people are still doing. And I would see people coming in with their phones. At that time, of course, BlackBerry was a lot more popular than it is now.
Right.
And the BlackBerry, remember, was called the CrackBerry because it was so addictive. People were like, right. Oh, another email, another notification, another thing, right? And I noticed people would be checking phones during some workshops and stuff. And I thought, oh, this is different. And then, of course, you know, better and more addictive devices come out. And I remember at the time there was like this kind of debate where some facilitators would brag and say, you know, when people come to my workshop, I have everybody put their phones into a basket in the door and they're not allowed to touch them during my workshop. And I thought, And I remember some guy telling me that at a L&D, a learning and development gathering that I was attending. And I looked at him and I said, you know what, to be honest with you, if I came to your workshop and you asked me to put my phone, that, you know, my personal phone in a basket, I would probably just not bother going to your workshop, because for me, that was such a, you're taking away some freedom, and I'm an adult, not a child, and I can handle this. And so I remember that night, I decided that I was going to, you know, ride the wave instead of trying to push it back.
Right.
And I remember getting home that night and thinking, okay, this is absolutely going to disrupt my industry, where we're used to face-to-face, you know, even with online learning. People call it the second or even third screen, where I might be doing a webinar or I might be doing online training, but that doesn't mean someone doesn't have Facebook open on their phone beside their laptop.
Right.
And so I realized at that time that this disruptive force of devices and digital and apps and all of this was going to not be something that I would be able to push against and tell people, for example, put your phone in a basket. So I decided to incorporate devices into my training. I decided to do training through text messages. I decided to use chatbots. I decided that if people were already going to have this addictive device in their hand, why not use it during the workshop instead of telling them, you know, like their kids, put this in a basket and you can't touch it.
Right.
So I remember that was a really good turning point for me to think about the fact that, like I mentioned earlier, there's so many things we can't control. Right. So when there's something like that happening, if you're just going to fight it, you're going to exhaust yourself and be so frustrated.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And these days, you cannot remove devices from people. It feels like part of people.
Yeah.
And in the workshops that I do, like, we typically say that please pay less attention to the devices. And my philosophy is that if your workshop is good enough, it takes away their attention from devices and they are paying attention to you. If you are not, they are paying attention to their device or something else, probably they are not getting that much from your workshop. So that's an implicit feedback for you on the spot too, right? But I love the way that you said teaching through text messages back then. Like right now, there are apps and like different ways of teaching, but teaching through text messages, that's something for itself.
Yeah, that was interesting back then. That was, oh my God, that's probably 6 years ago, maybe. I don't even remember now. But at that time, it was really difficult for me to find a platform to be able to do that with. Like you said, like now there's lots of ways, but the only place I could find tools for that at that time was in the public school scenario. There was an app called Remind, I believe it was called, that was made for public schools and for teachers. And that's what I used at that time for my SMS-based learning program that I developed. Because what I saw, and it was kind of interesting, I was kind of following my own experience and the experience of my friends. I don't know if you remember, but, you know, back in the kind of beginning of cell phones, like when you could have, what, I think 100 texts a month or something like that. And I would, and my friends too, we wouldn't even use up 100. Which is kind of crazy to think of that right now, but it's true. And then I remember the first time I went over 100. I got to like 120 because I was with friends on a trip in Montreal and we were texting each other to kind of figure out where we were going to meet, where we were going to meet for breakfast and all this. And I thought, oh, I guess I need to up my texting to, you know, a bigger plan. And then got more and more and more. And that's when I realized, oh, wow, we are using this every day throughout the day. Well, why don't I try to put some learning in this spot, in this space? Sure. And so my kind of motto, I guess, has always been frictionless learning, where I'm trying to take away any kind of barriers or extra effort for someone who's going to be learning something, so that there's less chance that they won't engage with the learning. Because the more barriers you put in someone's way, the less chance they're going to do the learning. So, for example, I used to say at that time, because it was all about mobile, the less taps, the better. If it takes me 10 taps on my phone before I get to module one of your learning program, then you've designed it. You've not designed it properly.
I heard the rule is that 3 taps or less when you want to get to something on a website. Yep. So if you're more than that, people are going to drop off.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I thought SMS-based training was a really good idea at that time, because there basically was no tap. It just came right to your phone.
Yeah, yeah. I remember those days. I remember those days that you need to count your character limits.
Oh, yes. Not
moving more than 140, so that doesn't count as 2. And then they moved on to data, and then they moved on to bring your family and friend as like a limitation. So lots
the good
of
old days.
And nowadays, basically, you can have a phone that has unlimited data, right?
Yeah. So how about, like, in your situation, like I said, I love that phrase where, I'm going to misquote you, but responding versus following the plan is basically the main idea.
Right. Responding to change over following a plan. Yeah.
Yes. Responding to change versus following a plan. Love it. I'm going to put that on a t-shirt. So for yourself, like, how does that manifest itself in your work and life? Like, how do you practice that?
I can tell you from the current situation that I'm in, the focus has been shifted because I'm working with teams and leadership to help them to go through an agile transformation. So the manifest of the transformation has changed. So at this, like before this thing happened, we were working on figuring out what's next to elevate the teams and where do we want to get them to a point. In what part of the journey they are. And now it's becoming, with all this disruption, become what is the new norm. So we are trying to figure out what is the new norm. We are trying to facilitate for the people to, for themselves, define what the new norm is. And with all these sudden disruptions, sudden changes, the work hour has changed. People are working after hours, before hours, so that not everyone jammed the system, because everyone at all of a sudden tried to work remotely and they are forced to do that, right? So there's no option about it, right? So we are mostly working with the teams to comfort them and figure out what is the best way to go next. So we are not losing the data that we had from before. So we are keeping the data, keeping that, say that this was our norm because of this disruption. This is our norm that is maybe, let's say, 80% effectiveness or 70% effectiveness compared to the previous normal, right? And then when everything gets back to normal, that would be our peak. We want to get to that peak. We are not going to lose that. And we want to go beyond that, but this is a J curve that all of a sudden that happened, and we are going deep into that. The moment that we figure out how we can come out of the valley, that would be an awesome story to tell.
I was just going to say, you're going to have incredible stories from this for sure.
True.
So with responding versus following a plan, if you were to train somebody how to get their head wrapped around that thought or that approach, how would you suggest, for example, that someone like me practices that to be able to get that as a more of a habit or a way of thinking?
So I would ask individual to be self-aware of what their goal are and on a daily basis, think about that and think about, okay, so is the goal that I'm working toward, is it something that I always, is it something that bringing true value for me and for my customer and for my organization? And depending on which one you put first, like, or a combination of them, then you can focus, okay, so my goal has changed today compared to last week or compared to the previous day. Okay, so how would I respond to that? And defining your goal might not be that easy, or you might not know what your goal is at some point. Like when with the client that I work with, they're like, I don't know what my goal is because my leader didn't tell me exactly, or I'm ambiguous about where shall I go. And for that, I'm suggesting to pick what you know best, right? And work toward that, and then pivot when you have more information. If that's what you thought, go forward. If not, pivot. We prior to this recording, we were talking about loops, right? So yeah, the feedback loops that you can implement for yourself, the shorter the loops that you can implement, the better chances of you can respond to change faster over following a plan. So don't lay down a plan that, another thing is don't get in love with your plan or love the idea that you put in place. This is an amazing plan that I put in. And the trick for that is that do not spend and invest too much on planning, right? If you invest too much on, let's say, a plan, then you fall in love with it because that's what you spend your time on it, right? So instead, focus on the shortest viable plan that you can get to and get to your goal that you want and follow that and pivot as much as you need. So that's...
That is a... So I love that kind of thinking. I got to be honest, I frustrate people because I do follow that rule. And I've heard over the years, when you think about training, like you also do workshops, that I don't remember exactly what the ratio is, but I've heard something like people say, you know, for every hour that you're in a quote unquote classroom or workshop, you should have about 5 hours of planning or you know, whatever behind that 1 hour or something like that. And I remember hearing that kind of talk and people saying you have to be prepared and, you know, what's your agenda? What are you doing for the first 45 minutes, then the next hour? And I've been asked by clients to supply this kind of agenda to them. They're like, we want you to come in and do a half day workshop. And what's going to happen between 9 and 12? And I have to lay it out. At 9:10, this is going to happen. At 9:30, this is going to happen. At 10:30, it's going to be break. And I gotta tell you, like, it drives me nuts because based on what you just said, you know, not being in love with your plan, for example, being willing to pivot, being okay with that idea that there's change. In my brain, I think, wait a second, like I'm going in for a half day workshop with, let's say, 50, 60, 70 adults or whatever it might be, who all come into that room with prior experience, knowledge, thoughts about things. There are probably people who have, you know, some cognitive dissonance to what's going on because they're actually being distracted by what happened in the morning back at home with their kids and their spouse, for example. Maybe they had to take a detour because the construction happened that they weren't expecting. There's a whole bunch of things going on in that room. And how can I think that my planned agenda for that 3 hours is going to go exactly according to plan? It just is impossible. We're dealing with human beings who have emotions, who make mistakes, who might want to focus on some other detail that I hadn't anticipated. And so for myself, obviously I want to have some sort of plan. Like I want to have, let's say, exercises that I want people to do. I want to maybe have a few slides to kind of guide the thinking. I want to make sure that the main idea that I've been hired to deliver is clear to people, let's say about empathy, for example, or something. But beyond that, for myself, I think that having a tried and true, very specific minute by minute plan is a mistake because then you're trying to force people into a journey that they might not want to take with you.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's dangerous because then as soon as people feel like we were mentioning before threat, or they feel that something is not going, you know, the way that they are comfortable with, they will shut off. And then the phones start coming out or people start walking to the washroom more often or these types of things. So I love that sentence. Don't fall in love with your plan. That's brilliant.
Can share an experience of mine when I was doing a workshop on teaching on some basic agile foundation and fundamentals, which wasn't that intensive, but because people that were coming into the workshop and the learning, they were being disrupted to their organization so much. There's so much happening that their minds were not there. And after an hour or two that we were in the workshop, one of them got so agitated that he stood up and he was just shouting that this is stupid, why we are doing this. I'm like, well, what happened here? Like, we are just going to, and this is not very intense, right? This is like just basics of agile. Like, I was just thinking, have I offended anyone. Like, well, no, nothing happened. So we just took a break and then figure out that there are lots of baggage that they're coming with. Like, so many things happened yesterday in their organization they needed to dial that down, like, and they need to comprehend, like, they need time to come to process that. And if you're a geek, compile that maybe. So at that moment, the workshop was not valuable for them. So then I said to them, guys, we were planned for having lunch around 12. Do you want to have it very early, maybe at 10:30, right? Maybe 10:30 to 11:15 for 45 minutes. Then come back and see what we can do. So at that time, for 45 minutes, we plan to take it in a different route, right? We talk about complexity and how we deal with a complex world, right? We moved away the conversation of, it's not about agile and how you do that, but it's about, like, your professional life. So
yeah, that's so excellent.
So that was basically responding to change, or responding to what you see as the change happen in their life, right? And not following, like, oh, I was being paid to deliver this workshop, right? No, it's not the workshop that you deliver that you bring value, the connections that you make. If you help them get there to what's best for them, yes, that's what they really value, right? And then they say, oh, that workshop was amazing. They might not remember, right? Back in 2-3 years that it was about agile, what it was about. But similar to the experience that I had at your workshop or your talk, I remember it was great because it was engaging. It was, the message was received, right? And so now we still have this connection, right? But if you had to say, okay, this is what I want to deliver, it might not have that effect on people.
Yeah, it's very true. So how have you managed to bring yourself to this point where you are okay with that scenario that you described, where you recognized after someone had a pretty strong emotional reaction that you had to pivot and change the rest of the workshop? Like, how have you managed to get yourself to that point where that kind of approach is okay and you feel comfortable doing that, even though it's kind of more unknown and quote unquote not according to plan?
Right. Like anything that I tried for the first time, it was scary. And this wasn't the first time, but when I facilitate sessions, typically I try to feel the room. I don't like using the terminology feel the room, but I don't have a better word for
that. Right.
I try to understand if people are still following, where do we want to get them, or do they want to go. Sometimes I try to stop at certain point and ask them if this process is still working for you guys, right? So I just get some feedback from them. If not explicit at the implicit break times, I ask them, or like at the coffee, I go and talk to some of them, see how it goes for them, right? So some of these things, and as you said, for every 1 hour that you deliver, there's a rule that you need to spend 5 hours for that. So I say that 5 hours shall be spent about the alternative paths that you might take, right? If something goes wrong, if something, for example, if they come in and they knew all about the design thinking, for example, right? And they just come in and you are doing a workshop on that. So what's your plan for that, right? Do you want to do a Q&A on that? Do you want to do like a real design sprint with them, right? Do you want to do a design on the fly? Like, what are the other things that you can do that you can bring value for the time that they are spending on?
That's a great idea. So basically, if I'm hearing you correctly, and it makes sense, is if there are 5 hours, for example, behind that hour, it would probably be better spent finding other tools and exercises and approaches that you can have kind of pull out of your toolkit when you need it, sort of on the fly, so to speak. So is that sort of what you've been doing, is kind of learning other ways to engage people if things kind of go off the rails or go in a different direction? Is that sort of your approach?
Yeah. And it depends on your audience as well. So I try to understand who is coming, and based on the audience that you're getting, design it and figure out what other paths it might taking you, and prepare for those things, right? It's different from team member to team leader to a director to a VP to a C-level people that come into your training, mm-hmm. is going to be very different. The type mm-hmm. of questions, the answers that they are looking for, mm-hmm. Some of those are more about like, give me this answer, I don't mm-hmm. have much time. Some of them are more open to co-create those answers with you, right? Mm-hmm. And the solutions. Yeah,
I love that word co-create. And it's funny, I was just thinking of that the last night with something upcoming. I always want to co-create with people, because what's so interesting is, although you might, like in your example as well, you're being brought in as the expert, but that doesn't mean that the people in the room or the people on the project don't also have some value, some ideas, some approaches, plans, for example, that will really help. And that's the one thing that I'm always saying to my clients, is that I'm here to co-create the solution with mm-hmm. you. I'm not going to just do kind of a discovery where I clarify your challenges and find out what's going on, and then go back, ideate and develop this solution that then I'm going to come back and say to you, okay, this is what you have to implement. Through the whole process, I this is at least what I, one little piece I've taken from the Agile community, is this idea of iterative cycles of feedback loops and things like that, where I discover your challenge, I do some ideation, but then I'm always checking in with you to find out, is this making sense? Does this fit with your people, with your scenario, with your organization? If yes, keep going. If not, do another iteration, do some more ideation, do a different approach. And then in the development, like, is this possible? Do you have the resources to make this possible? For example, if I'm suggesting people got to learn through SMS or text messaging, well, maybe you don't allow people to use their phones while they're in the warehouse, for example. Mm-hmm. So then that doesn't work. So then got to go back and figure something else out. So I love the ability to kind of iterate and be, if I can use the word agile in this approach, in that I'm not going to think that just because it's my idea, it's going to be the best idea. It's going to be something that's co-created with the client. It's going to be iterative. There's going to be constant feedback, because if the solution doesn't fit, it goes back to the idea of friction. If there's too much friction, if there's too many barriers, this is not going to work. But what I find, and I'm not sure if you find this too, is that once you start digging in, the thing that you were brought in to solve ends up being a lot bigger than you expected. And that sometimes there are other pieces that you hadn't considered that are going to make barriers to your solutions. And so I find that that's a very interesting kind of, how do I say this? Like, being able to kind of say to the client, you asked me to do this one thing, but I discovered that there's these other pieces that are going to prevent my proposed solution from actually, you know, going forward.
Yeah, typically when I'm teaching coaching to Scrum Masters and other coaches, I tell them that the first thing that your client brings you is not the real thing that they want you to coach them on. There are underlying stuff there that you need to peel and explore with them. And then when you get to the root, then you can be very impactful. And if you cannot get into the root cause of that, then there are some challenges that you need to overcome before getting to the root. Maybe they are not trusting you. Maybe they are not open enough to share with you. Maybe they don't believe in this process that someone outside there can come and help me, right? So if they are not open, or if you heard the term coachable, if they're not coachable, right? There's not much that you can do. And that, I believe, translates to any situation, not only coaching, but as you said, like if they are coming with a problem at hand, they might not know what the underlying problem is. Maybe they are sharing symptoms with you only, right? Then as I tend to use the terminology as a doctor. So you are the doctor for them. You're the expert there. You look at the symptoms and you try to, based on your experience, guess what is the best guess for the problem they have, and hopefully treat them with something or give them some solutions that can help them or get them better. So
And if you have the mindset that we've been talking about of being okay to respond to change and be okay with it, then in that scenario that you're describing of, you know, you've looked at some symptoms, but you really want to find the cause and the actual challenge that needs to be solved, then we also have this idea of disruption too, right? This reality of disruption, because I can imagine, let's say, for example, if we kind of craft a little story here, that maybe, let's say back in January, you were hired to help a team on Agile and rolling out this kind of new process, and you were discovering that you were just kind of dealing with symptoms and there were underlying root causes that you wanted to dig into. So you're making some suggestions and there's back and forth. So come end of February, you're thinking, okay, maybe we need to actually focus on this other piece. And the client is like starting to agree with you and figuring out ways to make this new piece happen for you. And then along comes a global pandemic in March and you can't make any steps forward, but you're still working with the client. Right. So I think there's always these constant indicators that point us in the direction of being okay with things we can't control. Right. And so I think this idea that you're referring to, where in the background, you are always adding to your toolkit, you are always learning, you are, you know, figuring out things that you can kind of add to your little tool bag, so that whenever something changes, which is all the time, that you can pull out that new tool, or you can pull out that new exercise, or these new questions that bring up a different kind of conversation.
True. And don't be hesitant or don't be afraid of using them, right? Because you might learn something and say, yeah, I learned it, I need to practice it, then I do it in real life. But if the time comes and you know about some technique, this is your chance to practice it, just go at it, like be courageous enough to do it. You might fail, but it's in the real life, so you get lots of learning from it, right? Don't invest too much into it. Don't invest, like, when you want to fail, you want to fail fast, so don't practice something that takes 3 months, like practice something that takes 1 week at most, right. A day.
And how do you navigate that conversation though? Because if I'm saying to you, for example, that I'm going to pay you for, you know, I'm going to have you on a retainer for multiple months, for example, to do some work, and you tell me, as the person who's, you know, paying you, that you've only got a plan for the next 2 weeks, but I'm hoping that you're going to tell me what to do for the next 6 months.
Right.
How are you navigating those conversations?
Right. So I was giving a talk called it The Golden Hammer of Transformation Culture. The golden hammer is something that you look at everything as a nail and you hit that with the hammer. So the whole idea was that. And one of the examples that I was giving, or one of the scenarios, was exactly that. I was going in with the mindset that we are going to do an agile transformation, but the ask was, oh, if we are doing agile transformation, we need to have a 6-month plan at least. Mm-hmm. We are not asking for a 2-year plan, but at least 6-month plan, we need to have it there. And my mindset was that it's agile, so we are going to do on a iteration basis, let's say a monthly or 2-week basis. So I pushed back a little, but I figured out that this is not going to happen. As much as they say that we are agile, they are not there yet. So I need to conform to what the ask is. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to influence them even. So I gave them what they asked for the 6 months, right? This is the plan for the 6 months. This is where we are going to get at. But through giving them those plans, I get an agreement with them that this plan is going to get changed. Right. Because we are agile and we are going to look at this plan on a monthly basis. So on a monthly basis, even before, on a monthly basis, on a bi-weekly basis, I was sending them updates about the plan. And on a monthly basis, we had official review of the plan. So it kind of like a sprint at the month basis.
Right.
So we looked at the plan and then, and at the 6 month, they figure out they wouldn't ask me about the 6 month ahead plan because they get used to that 1 month basis. And so on a monthly basis, we sit together and we get the plans. So the art would be to find a way in organizations or working with people to influence and implement those kind of mindsets. If you show them that it's working, they wouldn't say no, because 99% of people are good people. They have good intentions. If they're asking you for a large plan, it's because it worked in the past for them. It's the best thing, the best way that they know, right?
That's a great idea, because you're kind of subtly showing them the mindset and the approach that you want to do without it being super implicit. That would, you know, kind of get their back up, for example, and right. make them feel like a little bit fearful of this thing that they're not sure about. Right. It's a delicate experience. Like I find sometimes it's almost like a ballet, right? Where like you're kind of taking people on this little dance, and you're kind of being a little bit ginger about it while you're stepping around things and being careful what you say and don't say. But in the way that dance happens, it's more of a demonstration. Like when you go see, I don't know if you've ever gone to a live dance performance, but the interesting thing about it that I think relates to this is you're seeing a demonstration, right, of what is actually been going on behind the scenes, which is tons of practice, lots of stretching, lots of sore toes, lots of, you know, probably pulled muscles, all of the, you know, the counting in their heads, all that kind of thing. And it's, I think it's so similar to what you just described, where you have all these tools and you have all this mindset kind of underneath or behind the scenes, but you're demonstrating how the dance works. And right. so, like you said, by month six, the client was like totally fine right. with the way you were doing the dance because right. the demonstration of it made sense.
Right. Right. And as you said, they were sore toes. They were those.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the back, right? I told very nicely, but those things happen, right? It wasn't an easy ride to get there, but when you get there, it's very nice. It's like you figure out, oh, my God, like you need to have patience as well. You need to understand where they are coming from as well, right?
Yes.
So it's all plays into that. So Jamie, for our audience, I wanted to ask you this. What are the learning tips or techniques that you can share with them in this online world that now we are in? What are the one thing or two thing that you can share with them that they need to focus for the people that are putting out training online? They have not done it before. Is there something that they have to pay attention to that is a must that you can share with them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually had a conversation about this last week with someone doing quite a bit of online training. And I think one of the main things you have to consider at any time of the year, but especially now when you're in this global pandemic, most people are in lockdown or self-isolation, whatever you want to call it. So most people are in the scenario where they're stuck in the house. A lot of people have kids, you know, or a partner. Some people, of course, live alone, but you are at home. And so it's a very different sort of scenario now. You're trying to figure out, how do I navigate getting my work done when my kids are not in school and they're like 5 years old and they're running around the house and asking for more food, for example. And at the same time as this, you have the news, right, telling you that, you know, 900 people a day are dying in Spain or Italy, or over 1,000 in the United States. And so there's this collective shared trauma that I believe is also happening right now as well. Mm-hmm. And so when you take into consideration your audience, which you should obviously always do when you're doing any kind of training, but, you know, online as well, I'm always thinking about what's their circumstance or their scenario and the mm-hmm. emotions involved. And this is where I was mentioning before we got on this call about experience design, where you're thinking about the touch points involved in the journey that someone's going to take with you and the emotions that are connected to each one of these touch points. Are they what I like to call magical moments or miserable moments? Well, right now, there's a lot of miserable moments for people. There's not so much magic going on, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There's tons of people dying. There's tons of people getting sick. Healthcare systems are overloaded, etc., and we're stuck in our house. And so in that reality, are you going to design an online learning experience, if you want to call it that, that lasts for 2 hours, for mm-hmm. example? Well, I don't think that makes any sense. Right now, most people are just trying to survive. They've got a lot of cognitive load. They've got a lot of things they're thinking about, like going to the grocery store right now is not just a normal grocery store experience. You have to think about hand sanitizer. You have to think about a mask. You have to think about standing outside in line and being, you know, 6 to 8 feet apart from the person in front of you and all of these things. And so this cognitive load that's increased for us, in my mind, means why then do you think that in the middle of someone's day with all of this crazy stuff going on, they're going to be willing to sit down for 2 hours with you online and learn something? And so one of the things that I think we should consider right now is just the length of time that we think someone is going to sit with us and learn something. Because I'm a little bit frustrated right now that I keep seeing on social media people saying, oh, you have extra time right now. You're not commuting. You're not going to work. You're not doing these things. And so it's a perfect time to be productive and bake bread and learn a new language and do all this stuff. And I'm saying, I think it's a perfect time for people to slow down, reflect, and just have the space in their mind to be able to survive this and to make sense of it. And so in the middle of that, do I want to learn new things? Do I want to spend an hour on a course? Maybe not. Mm-hmm. So my first recommendation for people would just to be to think about the length of time you're asking someone to dig into something new when their brain might already be overloaded. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of people, unfortunately, who work under micromanagers who, like I said, right now are probably going a little bit crazy and are probably driving them crazy because they're working from home. They can't see what they're doing every minute of the day. And so you pile on top of that new learning or new demands. It's a struggle. So think about that scenario. You and I were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, you had this workshop where a lot of change had happened in the organization before you came into their lives. And so halfway through, that guy stands up, he kind of freaks out and says, like, what the hell are we doing? Well, I think it's a very similar situation right now. It's called psychic entropy is what that's kind of the term is here, where people are coming into your designed experience with other stuff going on in their brain. And so if I'm going to create online learning and I'm have someone who's, you know, been at home in self-isolation or not, let's say after this pandemic is over and someone's listening to this podcast and the world is back to quote unquote normal again, what is definitely happening to everybody who's going to be on your webinar or your online training is psychic entropy. There's psychic entropy, meaning that I am on your online training program, I'm on your webinar, but in the background, in my mind, I am thinking about, I lost my job. Right. Where's my money coming from? My kids are frustrated. They're feeling sad. They don't see their friends. They have a birthday party coming up and none of the friends can come because of a global pandemic. Right. I'm thinking about the fact that my groceries are about to run out, but I have anxiety about going to the grocery store. I'm thinking about that fight that I just had with my partner maybe 2 hours before because we're getting so frustrated at being at home every day, all the time together. Like, all of these things are in someone's brain while they're trying to do your training or while they're trying to pay attention to your webinar. And so with that reality, I think it's a very smart consideration to design instances in your, I don't know, webinar, online course, whatever you're doing, where you give people the space to kind of release that psychic entropy or to have a bit of time to focus in on what you're doing and to let that other stuff sort of go by the wayside or deal with it if they need to deal with it. Like, you recognize that with that one workshop you talked about, that those people, based on all the stuff that was going on in their organization, were incapable of paying attention really to what you were talking about and to being part of what you were trying to deliver for them. And so you changed course and you allowed them that sort of cognitive space to let go of those distractions that were happening in their brain and in their mind. And I think that's a really important piece to consider is because everybody's coming to your experience with other stuff going on in their brain, is there something you can design, like a fun kind of activity or a get to know you kind of thing, or what are 10 things all of us have in common, or even being really implicit about it, or just saying to people, I know you're coming into this with a whole bunch of anxiety, with a whole bunch of other thoughts going on. How about we just spend a few minutes just getting that out of our heads and down on paper, for example. Write down the five distracting thoughts that you have right now, just to get them out of your head and to leave them on that piece of paper before we go forward.
Right.
I think that's a really important thing to consider right now, because we are all having, I believe, a little more cognitive load on our plates than usual.
Right.
And so with that reality, how am I supposed to learn something if I don't have the space for it?
That's a very good thought. I think that's something that all of us should do, not only for learning online, but maybe even for some of the meetings that we have, like anything that span more than half an hour, I may say, we need to address those things, because I have been on so many online meetings that the kid came in or the husband passed by and you have to talk to them, right? So that's the situation that we live in, right? And that's the cognitive overload that you say. Like when we are sitting here, we are thinking, oh, my wife's meeting is starting soon. I have to go grab my daughter, right? So what if this meeting goes over, right? So
I think it's basically just recognizing that we are humans. And because of that, we are all living in challenging and different scenarios. And of course, it's impossible to design for everybody that's going to be in your workshop, for example, or online course. But if there's no consideration to the fact that people have a life outside of what you've designed for them, it's probably not going to land as well as you would like it to.
Right. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Yeah, no worries.
Thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience? Is there anything else that you want us to talk about before we say goodbye?
The only thing I will repeat is be okay with the fact that there are things outside of your control. Life is always, always, always going to be that way. Right. And the sooner you come to terms with accepting that, the better off I think you'll probably be. I mean, you could have a brand new car that you bought last week and you still drive it today and it breaks down on the way to your destination. So nothing is for sure. And the sooner we're okay with that, I think the easier time we're going to have in life.
Right. Change is the only constant, as you mentioned. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for spending the time with me on the Lean on Agile podcast.
And thanks for inviting me. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, it was a pleasure having you.
Yeah, same. And I love, as I said, the title of your podcast. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you too.